My name is Dr. Molly Turco, and better imaging faults and fractures will help to create a better link to what we see in the field at the outcrop scale versus what we see in like image logs and cores, and all tying that to seismic data. It all gets tied together.
Welcome to SEG's Seismic Sound Off, conversations addressing the challenges of energy, water, and climate. I'm your host, Andrew Gary. In this episode, Dr. Molly Turco discusses March's special section on imaging faults and fractures in the leading edge. Molly offers her expertise in navigating the persistent hurdles and characterizing faults and fractures, especially ones below seismic resolution. Molly sheds light on the crucial role of imaging these hidden networks and understanding their impact on production, injection, and completions, with a clear message that faults and fractures are neither inherently good or bad. This conversation emphasizes common misconceptions and emphasizes the importance of detailed imaging to gauge their significance. The conversation also touches on the broader implications of this topic for the energy transition, highlighting the continued relevance of structural geology in emerging fields like carbon sequestration and geothermal energy. This episode showcases the subsurface as a complex picture requiring patience, curiosity, and a multidisciplinary approach. Please check out the show notes for all the valuable links referenced in this conversation. And now, here is my conversation with Molly Turco. Well, you were gracious enough to serve as a guest editor for March's The Leading Edge, which, as the question at the top I hint at, is focusing on imaging faults and fractures. Why is it important to illuminate the fault and fracture networks in the subsurface?
So we know that they're down there, but what we don't always know is, are faults and fractures good, or are they bad, or are they insignificant? And really, the only way to answer those questions is to do your best to image them and then relate that to other data sets that are maybe a little bit more meaningful, such as production or injection or completions, you know, anything like that, operational. Are those faults and fractures impacting those things that become very important? And you're not going to know the answer to that unless you really understand your faults and your fracture networks, which, of course, you need to be able to image those. And that helps to kind of understand what's going on down there.
Has that been an understanding in the geoscience space for a long time, that faults and fractures may or may not be helpful? I mean, those words, my just first thought is a negative, like they're bad. But is it known in the geoscience community that they could be just there?
It's a wrong thought process, but it's a very common thought process. A lot of times when something goes wrong, people say, oh, well, there's faults down there, or there's fractures down there. Or when things go right, you know, say, oh, we hit a very permeable fault or fracture zone. But they really can be either. They can be very insignificant to your reservoir, not impacting things, but they can have a huge positive impact and uplift your permeability and your productivity. But they can also have cons, you know, if those fractures and faults are linking to water and you don't want to make that water, that can be very bad. They can also become reactivated like faults. Seismicity is not really something that you want either. My job is to just kind of remind people that they're not necessarily good or bad, but it's important to really understand them so that you can answer that question for your reservoir. Are they good or are they bad?
What are some of the persistent challenges you find in characterizing fault and fractures in the subsurface?
One of the common themes is fractures are obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but they're commonly below sub-seismic resolution. And I think with, you know, advanced technology using seismic attributes or seismic acquisition, we're getting a little bit better at imaging things that are smaller and smaller and smaller. So one challenge has always been, you know, what's happening at a sub-seismic scale? And then what's happening horizontally as well. A lot of times we get these vertical wells that have all these data sets, but we don't always get that data horizontally as well. So I think there's also a challenge relating the vertical to the horizontal, and then, of course, relating that to your 3D seismic data to figure out what's going on below that seismic resolution. Hmm.
There are three papers in this special section that will be presented. In these next few questions, we'll look at those. How does Chatelier's work provide valuable insights into identifying faults and fractures without using seismic data?
So this paper was very intriguing. It was a little bit out of the box. He actually didn't have 3D seismic data presented in his paper. So he actually gave some really great ideas of how you might be able to detect faults in the absence of 3D seismic. And I would just, you know, encourage folks to go take a look at that. There are several processes and techniques that he put out there. And I would love to give those a try, especially in areas where you do have 3D seismic, to kind of cross-correlate to see how well this works for your reservoir. Because oftentimes in a basin, we might have 3D seismic in one location, but not in another. And if you're finding that some of the methods he proposed are accurate at predicting faults, why not take that to a larger scale outside of your 3D seismic resolution? So I would definitely recommend reading that one just to kind of think outside the box of what we normally think about tools for looking for faults and fractures in the subsurface.
That's a great recommendation. What did you discover looking at Geiser et al.'s examination of using the shear wave splitting reflectivity contrast for imaging that had its own little nice Greek symbol for this one?
Yeah, so I'm not a geophysicist by training, and I don't think I realized that researchers could gain so much insight at looking at the differences between P and S components of the seismic data. And I think it really does a nice job highlighting the importance, how important it is to collect that 9-component data and to be able to analyze the shear wave splitting.
I recently spoke with Heather Beadle, and she highlighted her particular appreciation for aberrancy. I think she called it her favorite attribute on that podcast. What did you make of the case Salazar, Flores, and Beadle provided in encouraging interpreters to incorporate aberrancy attributes?
You know, I think it's also my new favorite attribute. I'm all for the structural attributes and anything you can do to kind of highlight the faults, maybe fracture zones or folds in the subsurface. And I kind of felt like it went beyond some of the classical structural attributes, and you got almost a sharper feel. Like visually, it was just a little bit more crisp at highlighting what could be faults and fractures in the subsurface. So I really appreciated that. And I think I'm definitely going to be using aberrancy in any of my future interpretations.
Well, it sounds like these papers gave you a lot to think on and utilize in your own work. How else might you say these papers will help support the interpreter when the seismic falls short?
So it really might depend on whether or not you have 3D seismic data. If you don't have 3D seismic data, I would refer back to Chatelier's work. I thought he had some great ideas. If you do have 3D seismic, you know, maybe think about the vintage of that data and what you can do with that. How well can you pull out those structural attributes that kind of help to highlight the faults or the fractures?
What were some of you, you've mentioned several of your takeaways from reading these papers. Is there anything else that stood out to you in reading these papers?
I guess I had some initial expectations versus what we ended up with in the end. You know, when I was asked to edit this, my initial expectations were we'd be receiving all these papers with 3D seismic and there would be these classic fault and fracture interpretations in it. But we really ended up getting three unique papers. One of them, you know, does a really nice job talking about the imaging. And then another one talks about the type of attributes you can use. And then there's even a paper in there that doesn't have 3D seismic data. So you're really getting three different perspectives and you're looking at three different topics and processes and results that you can look at. And that's really a unique way to kind of approach that. You're not just getting the same thing with every paper in a different area. They're each very unique on their own.
How does this topic impact the conversation around the energy transition, if at all?
So I kind of feel like many of these technologies that, you know, when we're adding energy to the system, they're still going to require your basic geology skills with structural geology at the top of the list. So fault and fracture kinematics, those are going to be vital to something like carbon sequestration or even geothermal. And the seismic data really helps to illuminate the subsurface and get a better understanding of these kinematics. So kinematics is kind of a fancy word to understand how the faults move, how they behave. These can help answer some questions to whether they're leaky faults or sealing faults and fractures. And I think, you know, we do this all the time with petroleum systems, but I think we still have to remember those petroleum system elements, especially when we get into something like carbon sequestration or even geothermal, because those fractures are going to be our migration pathways. And if you have your 3D seismic data, that can really help to understand how they might behave.
So you have these three papers in this special section that are touching on three different and unique areas. What else are some of the kind of most exciting opportunities for geoscience to innovate within this topic that you see?
Man, so I had to think really hard about this one. And I kind of see two things. One topic that's really hot right now is using something like AI with 3D seismic data to auto pick faults and fractures. And I've seen several vendors out there, but as a structural geologist, I wish there was a way to maybe edit those faults more easily, or, you know, maybe pick the ones that are just kinematically accurate versus the ones that are not kinematically accurate. I really see that being like an innovative opportunity in the future. I think that technology, it feels a bit early. I've definitely seen some good examples of AI picking faults, and then I've seen some pretty horrible examples of AI picking faults. And the trick is going to be having a software that allows you to easily adjust and edit those picks so that you can still have that human factor in there that can please somebody like a picky structural geologist when you're picking faults.
Yeah, I see that. You know, there's certain AI things I'm able to use it in my world with creating words, but I would just never think about just automatically putting that in without a human looking at them and thinking about that. So I'm sure the stakes are even much higher in picking faults and that kind of thing when the subsurface is involved. Is there a question that nobody is asking about managing imaging faults and fractures or developing better subsurface characterization?
You know, I reached out to Lily Horn and Heather Beadle, who were with me on this project, and we all kind of came to the same conclusion in a roundabout way. We really would love to see industry making seismic data more available to like academic researchers. So I work in industry and we have amazing 3D seismic, but it's proprietary. And if I could take that data and give that to somebody in academia who has a lot of time, a lot of knowledge to really dig in there, with them having access to that type of data, I think they could get some incredible results out of that. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the latest and greatest proprietary 3D seismic. We also talked about the importance of leveraging some of that legacy data. Sometimes plays that were hot 10 years ago, they're not hot now, but companies still own great seismic data. And it'd be nice to kind of allow academia and researchers to really dive into that data. And that can actually help them to develop better technology off of that. Maybe it's better attributes. Maybe it's recommendations for better acquisition in the future. And like what I would love to see is the technology to get seismic resolution down even smaller. I've always kind of heard the rule of thumb is like 40 feet, depends on depth, but I'd love to get it down to like 5 feet or 3 feet. You know, that would be a miracle. I don't know, but any type of like technology or research that can get us there would definitely be icing on the cake.
Yeah, in an interview right before this, we talked with Lindsay Hagee, who is talking about open data, and you can kind of have it maybe not an all or nothing where the industry is having this open data for everyone. Anyone can use it, but even just allowing academia to use it would maybe be a step in discovering new things. What do you want to know about this issue that you don't currently know?
I think it's It's pretty interesting to see how geophysicists are now working really hard to get as much information from the seismic data as they can, especially about subtle faults and fractures. Even though those are below seismic resolution, the physics might tell us that that's impossible. But when you throw in the geophysics and the humans in there, I think we're actually able to pull out a lot more info than what the physics says we can. And we also, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So I think always being curious about what you can get out of the data is a good thing. Kind of one other comment about the papers that we ended up with. One thing I didn't really think about, but they really demonstrate that the topic of like imaging faults and fractures is inherently multidisciplinary. There's not just a one size fits all. There's not a go-to method. There's not, you know, if you want to see faults and fractures, do X, Y, Z. It's really neat that there are different methods, and putting those all together, I think, is just going to get even better and better, especially with technology to help us along the way.
What challenge would you like to leave the listener from this conversation?
Oh, man, this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. But a fault or a fracture is more than just a fault or a fracture. I tend to hate the word lineament. It gets used often, and I always ask, well, what is that? And then they're like, if they say it's a fault, it's like, well, what kind of fault is that? You know, if we're going to talk about a fault in the subsurface, I'd love to know, like, is it a normal fault, a reverse fault, a thrust fault? What's the offset on it? You know, what's the timing on it? But so often, faults and fractures get thrown into this generalized bucket. And then once it's in that bucket, it's like, okay, are they good or bad? But there's so much more, and people just tend to ignore that stuff. And so I kind of feel like part of my calling is to highlight that faults and fractures are more than just faults and fractures. And let me help you figure out, are they good or bad? How are they impacting your reservoir? And let's quit using the word lineament and quit generalizing faults and fractures altogether.
Yeah, you mentioned how this is an inherently multidisciplinary work, and a lot of geoscience is that way. Is there something as a structural geologist that you, and it kind of similar, but maybe it's something else in addition that you would want a geophysicist to understand from your perspective as they're going about doing the work in the subsurface?
If you're an interpreter as a geophysicist, I would highly recommend understanding just basic fault and fracture kinematics, especially fault kinematics, because fractures, those tend to be subseismic. I always recommend to my geophysicist, if you are interpreting faults, look at your seismic at a one-to-one scale, which is really hard for geophysicists. They like to go 10 times vertical exaggeration, 20 times. But that really skews your fault geometries. But faults like to behave a certain way. They can be predictable. Normal faults like to dip at 60 degrees, and reverse faults like to dip at 30 degrees. And when you have that basic understanding of kinematics for faults, I think that will make you a better interpreter when looking at seismic data. And I don't know that a lot of geophysicists out there really wrap their head around it. We often see cross sections thrown out there with extreme vertical exaggeration, and you think you have these giant faults when really you just have giant vertical exaggeration.
Well, lastly here, Molly, if you had to describe your journey in one word, what would it be and why?
That was actually a tough question, but the word that keeps coming to mind is puzzled. I think this can fit, you know, almost any discipline, but in the world of structural geology and petroleum systems and even geophysics, like, you're always puzzled by something, which means you're always problem solving. You're always thinking about a solution. And from a structural geology perspective, I'm always thinking about how do things move. And sometimes being puzzled is something that's easy to figure out. And then sometimes it can be very frustrating. But it's a good place to be because your curiosity is always piqued. There's always something to figure out. So being puzzled is definitely not a bad thing. It's kind of fun, actually.
I feel like that's a good wrap up of this conversation, because it's kind of like faults and fractures aren't good or bad. They could be both. puzzled. It could be good or bad. It's not necessarily a determinant just because it's something. I like that a lot. Well, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you volunteering to work on this special section. And I'm excited for the listeners to start diving into these papers.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Seismic Sound Off. SEG creates these episodes to celebrate and inspire the geophysicists of today and tomorrow. Visit SEG.org to learn more. Email the show at podcast@SEG.org. This episode was hosted, edited, and produced by me, Andrew Gary, at TreasureMint. The SEG podcast team is Jennifer Cobb, Kathy Gamble, and Allie McGinnis. The podcast will return next week with a new episode. Until then, this is Seismic Sound Off, signaling off.